Hello, and welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Cooper. I'm sitting here today with Ruth Edmonds. She's an Israeli-British activist who has lived in the region on and off for 16 years. She's been mostly recently active with Boycott From Within. In the past, she's been active with Anarchists Against the Wall and has held different roles in various organizations from the Alternative Information Center and Ma'an Development Agency, Palestinian-Israeli Photography Collective Active Stills, and as a counselor for New Profile. Currently, Ruth is working as an advocacy officer, administrator, and tour guide for the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. It's an organization for human rights and peace established in 1997 to help end Israel's occupation over Palestinians. ICAD takes as its main focus, as its vehicle for resistance, Israel's policy of demolishing Palestinian homes in the occupied Palestinian territory and in Israel proper. Hello, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great. So we're here today to talk about these issues so that listeners back in the United States and Canada can get a better feel for all the intricacies of what's happening here, as it can be quite hard to understand from all the way across the oceans. And so I've been here now for 2 months, and I've talked to a lot of different people, and a lot of them are always saying that land and housing is one of the biggest issues in the conflict. And I would assume that your organization would agree, as that's their main focus. So can you explain a little bit about why you folks do what you do?
Yeah, sure. So, first of all, although absolutely our focus is on the issue of house demolitions, it's very much as a vehicle to expose the system of the occupation, the matrix of control that Israel has developed over the years, particularly in the West Bank and Jerusalem. So house demolitions are a really good way of presenting that image in a way that people can grasp and is understandable. Of course, on top of that, I think the issue of house demolitions is one of the most devastating aspects of the occupation in an already very devastating situation. And house demolitions are purposefully part of Israel's pretty systematic plan of displacing as many Palestinians as possible from both Jerusalem and the West Bank. House demolitions are a really great way of doing that. And so I think as such a key aspect of the occupation, it's also a key aspect for us as activists to focus on. I also think that back in ICAD's first incarnation as a direct action group, that it was also something that activists could really focus on as well in terms of being present on the ground in Palestine and trying to actually prevent demolitions from happening in the first place.
All right, and so to me it's an easy link to understanding, oh yeah, fighting against housing demolitions, that's definitely resistance. But I also feel like for someone who's actually experiencing the threat of their house being demolished and having people come, that there must be more to it, to the thought of resistance and this power you get from you folks helping. Can you explain a little bit about maybe how you think that when you do the building projects in summer, how the families feel, or what resistance kind of actually means and looks like in this context?
For us, I think definitely a lot of our resistance as ICAD is focused around the house rebuildings that we support and take part in. So every summer we've rebuilt a demolished home as sort of part of a summer camp. Now, prior to those internationals who come over for 2 weeks and help build a Palestinian home, there's a whole lot of stuff that happens way before they even get here. And the whole process is always done together with the Palestinian family. Because again, we're going through a process where we're not asking for a permit to rebuild. Of course, the family won't be getting it. And so it's a risk that the family are taking. So they first and foremost have to be the ones to make a decision on whether or not they even want their house to rebuild or if they're going to look for another solution. In this case, where this summer, where we're rebuilding a demolished home, the story of the family is pretty devastating. We're talking about sort of three separate families that are related, so two grandparents and then a son and another son and their wives and daughters. One of the sons passed away and his house was demolished, and his wife and children went to live with the grandparents. with her brother-in-law and wife and their kids. That house that's got 3 adults in and I think like 10 children then also got demolished. And so that whole unit went to live with the grandparents. Except the house the grandparents live in also has a house demolition order on it. So a pretty dire situation, and I obviously can't speak for the family, but I'm guessing that it's a choice, you know, question of do we risk it? Do we risk rebuilding and having our house demolished again, or do we live in this, stay in the situation that we're in? And I think doing a risk assessment for themselves, they're saying, okay, it's less of a risk. It for us at the moment, better we rebuild and risk being demolished in the future than living 17 people under one roof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people would want to build because they need to. They need a house. If they have no permit, you know, like, what are you supposed to do?
Exactly.
But also, it must have a huge financial, emotional, and physical cost on people. Did people ever talk about that with you?
Well, first of all, talking about the financial aspects, I mean, just in terms of applying for a permit, it's very expensive. I'll just take this opportunity to say something about issuing permits, particularly here in Jerusalem as well. It's not unusual in many countries for a local government or a local authority or municipality to request permits for building, whether it be a patio or a balcony or a second floor or a garage or whatever. You need to get a permit for it, which is not an unusual request. The reason you need to get a permit to build is so A, the local government can ensure that your plans match up to their plans. You know, every local authority will have a master plan for its region, its area, its town, its city, neighborhood, village, whatever. And to ensure that the standard of building is kept to a standard that's safe. I mean, these are not unusual requests. However, if the basic infrastructure of your neighborhood has barely changed in almost 50 years, the chances of you being issued a permit are going to be minimum. Because the local government can say, sorry, the sewage in your area is not good enough for you to build. Sorry, the water, we cannot provide the house with water, electricity, basic infrastructure, etc., etc. Basic infrastructure and development in East Jerusalem was frozen after the occupation. That was a purposeful policy to ensure that the non-Jewish population of the demographic did not grow beyond the level of 30%, which was the number of the percentage of Palestinians in Jerusalem in 1967. It was 70-30, 70% Jewish, 30% non-Jewish. Now, on top of that, the local authority will use all sorts of excuses not to issue permits, such as the house is built too much on a slope. It's Jerusalem. Go find a house that isn't built on a slope. The house is too close to a Jewish school. It's too close to a settlement. It's too close to a military infrastructure. It's too close to a police station. It's too close to a road used by settlers and all the military. So Palestinians know from the outset that the chances of them getting a permit are minimum. Now let's say they're going to apply for a permit anyway. They're going to try and get a permit because, well, they need to build a new floor. Their son just got married. Who knows? Here also there's a difference between Israeli construction and Palestinian construction. When Israelis build, more often than not, what will happen is that they'll lease land from the state. They'll build on that land, a few villas, a few apartments, whatever it is they're constructing, and sell those on. So that construction company incurs all of the costs needed to apply for permits. You know, it can swallow it, because you know, it's a big construction company. It's been doing big construction. When Palestinians develop and build, they do it mainly as individuals. And so it's an individual who's incurring all of those costs when it comes to applying for a permit. And even after you've spent your 90,000 shekels trying to get a permit to build your house, there's no guarantee that you're going to get one. Unfortunately, I don't have any statistics in terms of the number of permits issued to the number of permits applied for. These are numbers which are difficult to get from the local authority. They're obviously not very forthcoming with these kinds of statistics.
I wonder why.
And so it's definitely something that we need to look into more. So that's in terms of the financial cost. When your house is demolished, you have two options. You can either self-demolish or you can wait for the authorities to do it for you. Now what happens is that when you're given a demolition order, you're not told when the demolition is going to happen. From the moment that you have that demolition order, it could happen 10 days later, 10 weeks later, 10 months later, 10 years later, or even never. However, from the moment that you have that demolition order in your hand, you're living in a place of fear. You're waking up every morning and the first thing you're doing is checking to see if there are bulldozers outside your house. When you cause an entire population of people, or a large chunk of them, to live in a place of fear of their house being demolished, that's state terrorism. You're causing a huge amount of the population to live in a place of fear. And the emotional trauma that comes, forget about the day of the demolition. Before that, even just knowing in the back of your head that you've got this demolition order hanging over you, it takes away your sense of security. You can never really properly plan for your future if at any moment your home is going to be taken away. Now, as I was saying, there are two options. They can either self-demolish or wait for the authorities to do it. If they self-demolish, it's always going to be slightly cheaper than the authorities doing it for you. It's obviously still very expensive. You've got to hire a bulldozer. You've got to hire a moving company that will remove all your belongings. It costs a lot of money. If you wait for the local authority to do it, the local authority will come at 3 o'clock in the morning or in the middle of the afternoon when they know it's only the women and children at home. They come with a large security contingency. They get the family out of the house. The private contractor gets the belongings out, and then another private contractor, all the same one, will demolish it. At the end of the demolition, they're handed a bill and they have to pay for the demolition and the cleanup. So either way you're going to pay, it's much more, costs a huge much more, huge amount more when it's the local authority doing it or the civil administration in the West Bank. So either way, it's very expensive. And then of course if you're going to try again and apply for a permit or whatever it is afterwards, you're going to be spending a lot of money. I already touched a little bit about the emotional, psychological costs around house demolitions. But you can look at sort of male, females and children and how they affect those three groups in different ways. Mm-hmm. Palestine in general is quite a patriarchal society. Man suddenly finds himself in a situation where he can't protect his family, he can't provide for them, and they're taking away his home. It's very, very difficult emotionally to psychologically to deal with. And you do see higher rates of drug abuse, alcohol abuse and domestic abuse among families who've had their houses demolished. Palestinian women, again, incredibly traumatized by the demolition itself. And within the family home, it's a very matriarchal society. The female's very much in charge of what's going on and decision-making over her husband and over her kids. And then suddenly she finds herself living with her mother-in-law or her aunt, and she's no longer the matriarch of the family. She's no longer in charge of decisions around her kids and her husband. Again, you know, the house demolition is sort of one day and one aspect, and then it just has sort of a fallout effect, you know, for the rest of these people's lives. I mean, it doesn't just stop with that one day. again, with children, incredibly traumatizing. There was actually a professor in Gaza who did research on suicide bombers and found that over 50% had had their houses demolished as children. And on top of all of that, you can look at the Israeli army's own research. And the Israeli army has said when it comes to punitive house demolitions, that it doesn't deter people from carrying out attacks. In fact, it only inflames the people more. I mean, the best way, so what I say to my groups, to understand this issue of house demolitions, if you look at someone who's homeless, not from a lifestyle choice, so homeless was life has brought him to that place, and then you give him a home, his level of confidence goes up, right? You know, in our bureaucratic world, you need an address to do anything. When you have an address, you're registered in the system, you can get a job, you can open a bank account. I mean, all of these things matter in the kind of societies that we live in. You take all of that stuff away, it does exactly the opposite effect. You take away that person's confidence, you take away that person's sense of security, you take away that person's sense of having a base, and you're looking at someone who's going to be pretty angry at the situation he's in. And it's something, I mean, house demolition, having a home is a basic right. This shouldn't mm-hmm. be political. This shouldn't be about race or ethnicity or religion. Having a home is a very, very basic right.
For anyone who hasn't driven through Palestine, most of the houses are anticipating to build a second floor for when they do have families, mm-hmm. and they can move in. So there's a big sense of the way that culture works around building. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are builders, so a lot of them will have the main floor and then a second floor that looks empty with rebar waiting for the next bit, which mm-hmm. when you first go through without the awareness of how that culture works about building and having your family move in, it looks, well, it just looks strange and unfinished, and you have to start wondering what's happening around building in these areas.
In the US, I'm sure there are kids who are living in one state and the grandparents in Florida and the mother and dad back home in wherever, and we're not, it's okay, there's no criticism on that. It's just, on the other hand, there are still many, many societies and countries also where families stay very, very close to one another, literally in the same house, where the next generation of family live on the floor above, and that's also okay. What we're doing here in Israel is not allowing for any of that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's get into a little more of kind of historically looking at how the situation in East Jerusalem has become what it is that we sort of started mm-hmm. talking about. So after 1967, Israel gained more land, and East Jerusalem has since been illegally annexed.
Mm-hmm.
There are laws and policies in this region that are different from other parts of the occupied Palestinian territories.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you sort of explain what annexation actually is and the laws and policies that are in place now and how they affect people?
Mm-hmm. The annexation of land, mm-hmm. in the way that I understand it and in the sense that we're talking about here, when Israel annexed Jerusalem, it basically meant that they incorporated East Jerusalem into the local authority borders. So they basically changed those municipality borders and they created a new border for East Jerusalem. So if you get this map up of East Jerusalem, what they basically said in 1967 was, right, we need the most amount of land possible with the least amount of people on it. Because, you know, we don't want to get too many Palestinians in the local authority border, because then what are we going to do? So it was about, okay, we're going to have to incorporate large areas of populated East Jerusalem, but how can we take the least amount of people possible? So what land has got the least amount of people on it? Agricultural land. So the city of Jerusalem up until 1967 was literally the old city of Jerusalem and the surrounding basin around it. So surrounding areas, so Silwan, Sheikh Jarrah, area around the old city. That was the city of Jerusalem. Everything else was satellite villages undertaking agriculture, doing agricultural mm-hmm. work, providing city with produce. Very simple setup. Now, so that land was taken, and they left the villages that owned the land outside of the municipality borders, and they're in the West Bank, and either find themselves in sections Area C or Area B, depending where they are. Now, in terms of the laws, regulations, and policies, first of all, East Jerusalem isn't under martial law, like the West Bank is. So, just for your listeners at home, I'll just clarify that in the West Bank, Palestinians live under martial rule. They live under military law. And that means the military is dictating every step of the way. That's from birth to death. This isn't about just they live under military rule when they're arrested.
Mm-hmm.
It means in Area C, the army is the one that's issuing planning and development permits, or not issuing permits. It's the army who's controlling how kids get to and from school. It's really, the military rule is embedded into Palestinian life from birth to death there, in the form of the occupation. Now, in Jerusalem, it's not under martial law, first of all, not under military rule. In Jerusalem, that also goes for Palestinians. So in terms of like the identity cards that you hold, everyone in Israel has an identity card, and in the West Bank, it's different. So first of all, back in 1967, one of the first things the local authority did is they counted all of the Palestinians in living in Jerusalem. And they offered them either permanent residency status or citizenship. For political and legal reasons, the majority of Palestinians in Jerusalem decided to take permanent residency status. A permanent residency status is very, very similar to a green card in the US. So you can vote in local elections, you can't vote in national elections. So let's say just looking at the West Bank, for example, Palestinians in the West Bank can't vote in local elections and they can't vote in national elections. But I know that's the thing. It's dangerous to compare because it's not like the Palestinians have it any better because they can vote in local elections but not national ones. So in terms of their ID card, the status is different. But permanent residency status, again, I mean, you don't have citizenship of any state. You're stateless with a permanent residency status. But there are some Palestinians who also have a passport, Jordanian usually, because of Jerusalem being under Jordanian occupation between 48 to 67. So the permanent residency status basically means that you should have access to freedom of travel, health, education, all basic infrastructure, and so on. However, to hold on to this so-called privilege of having a permanent residency status in Jerusalem, you have to continually prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life. And this is called the center of life policy. And this means you have to constantly prove to the authorities that you're paying your council tax, you're paying your bills, that you're doing your shopping in Jerusalem, that you're sending your kids to school in Jerusalem, that you're working in Jerusalem. Constantly. To hold on to this privilege of having a permanent residency status, this has many implications. Having to constantly prove that Jerusalem is the center of your life, it obviously limits. You know, it's not unusual to find people who live in Jerusalem and work in Tel Aviv. As a Palestinian, you won't be able to do that. If you start living in Jerusalem, if you're living in Jerusalem, you start working in Ramallah, at some point the authorities are going to call you up, they're going to call you into their offices, the interior ministry of interior, and they're going to demand you explain to them where you're working, why you're working in Ramallah, and hey, perhaps on the way you'd like to go and live in Ramallah and get out of Jerusalem.
Which is a really short drive, by the way. Like, yes. If you think of your American perspective of commuting an hour to work, it's probably less to go to Jerusalem than Ramallah. Depending on how the checkpoint is.
Also. And that's the thing. Like, it's not unusual to have cities. Plummet. You saw the standard of living plummet. I mean, I can make comparisons also even just within Jerusalem in terms of settlers living in Palestinian neighborhoods and what the settlers have and what the Palestinians don't have. And to me, that's some of the most stark differences that you can see in East Jerusalem, because you'll have, it's unlike the West Bank. You go into the West Bank and the settlement's there on a hilltop or there in the valley. They're kind of close to the Palestinian villages and neighbourhoods, but they're far away enough as well that they're not neighbours.
Mm-hmm.
Jerusalem, you've got settlements smack bang in the middle of Palestinian neighbourhoods, right next door to them. So what do? Surround themselves with fences, surround themselves with security cameras, surround themselves with border police, and then get surprised when people aren't so keen on their presence there. So, for example, this is one of the sort of the great examples that I give, driving through, taking groups through East Jerusalem. We pass Jabal Muqabba, and as you're driving down through the valley, the sides of the valleys are just strewn with litter. Now, why? Because the majority of places in East Jerusalem don't have their garbage collected. Now, what do the local authorities say? The local authority says, roads are too dodgy, they're not good enough for the garbage collectors to drive on. Okay, so make the roads better, and then go collect people's garbage. No. Secondly, the garbage collectors themselves are in danger in the Palestinian neighbourhoods in which they drive, to which you could say, but the Palestinian garbage collectors themselves come from the very same neighbourhoods that you are saying is dangerous for them. So then what happens? There is a private garbage collection company that come around and collects the garbage, except they're not accountable to anyone. So in fact, the garbage isn't collected. So then what happens? It gets thrown on the sides of the valleys. It gets burnt during the spring and the summer. You're burning plastic on the sides of the valley. So then what happens? You see higher rates of cancer in Palestinian communities than you do in Israeli communities. Now what's more ironic than this?
What?
You carry on driving 50 metres down the road and you reach a settlement. Mm-hmm. Outside that settlement, there is a recycling bin for paper and for plastic. And that's when you start to ask yourself, okay, what is going on here? Here, if you're Jewish, they live in the same neighborhood. Here, if you're Jewish, you can have recycling bins. And you can go to bed at night knowing that you've done something nice for the environment. You live 50 meters down the road and you're not Jewish, they don't collect your garbage and you can burn on the sides of the valley. And this very stark difference is why we say that Israel is an apartheid state. Now I'm giving a very small, we're talking about garbage collection. It's nice, I understand we're talking about something that's very small. But when your garbage is collected, you don't notice it. You don't think about the place not being clean. You don't think about it not, you're used to it. This street out here that you came from, Bitsalam, gets swept from leaves. I have a compost bin. I can compost. I can separate my garbage and compost. Because I live in West Jerusalem. And here we invest money. Now, as I said earlier, the Palestinians have to constantly prove that Jerusalem is the center of their life to hold on to their permanent residency status, right? Which means they pay council tax and other taxes to the local authority. Now, 46% of Jerusalem's local authority taxes come from Palestinian neighborhoods. We only reinvest between 5 to 10% back into those same neighborhoods. What the state is doing is dictating to you the level of quality of life you can have as well. And that's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just a few examples of the of the sort of levels of bureaucracy and policy.
Yeah,
the policies that we have. And I will just say one last thing about this issue of policies and bureaucracy and laws and stuff that Israel passes. Israel constantly tries to present itself with a facade of legitimacy. We have green zones. You can't build in green zones. That happens everywhere. That's not unusual, right, to have green zones. But if entire areas of East Jerusalem are green zoned and they use it as excuses not to allow people to develop their villages, that means you're affecting the demographic. That means you can directly affect the demographic of Jerusalem by preventing people from expanding their neighborhoods and villages. Issuing permits. They say, sorry, house is too much on a slope. You need a permit to build. That's not unusual. Again, the facade of legitimacy is there. You scratch at the surface and you realize that permits are not issued to Palestinians because they're not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taking, it's sort of crumbling away at that facade of legitimacy is something that ICAD tries to focus on a lot in terms of awareness raising and education, because you don't see it. If you go out into East Jerusalem, just walk around the streets, you don't see here, you know, one park for Palestinians and one park for Jews, one restaurant for Palestinians and one restaurant for Jews. There isn't this segregation which is cut clear and obvious. It's an invisible segregation. It's a segregation of policies. It's a segregation of law based on lines of ethnicity. It's a problem.
Mm-hmm. I think another barrier for folks in Jerusalem is the fact that there's so many holy sites that mm-hmm. takes up a lot of the land mass in East Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So it's hard also to acquire a permit for even a place of land that maybe would exist that isn't being taken over by a park or by a holy site or mm-hmm. something else. And it's definitely used to the advantage of the Judaization of Jerusalem policies that are in place now.
Yep.
Yeah, and so what is the work that ICAD is actually doing on the ground?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think like many organizations in the sort of lifetime of an organization, you fluctuate in your level of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, about 2 years ago, ICAD found itself in a bit of a crisis where we had to decide whether or not we were going to stay functioning or if we were going to close shop, and we decided to stay functioning. But it does mean that we've had to reduce massively the amount of work that we were doing before. And just this year, we're starting to come back to our, you know, back on our feet, really, where we can do a little bit more than just tours, both here and abroad. And one of the projects that we're actually starting to work on is a project around the Judaization of Palestine, which is really exciting. So a lot of research is going to be going on around that. We want to be able to find a way to present the information that's clear, that informs, but also opens people to start questioning the situation much deeper. But for us, sometimes this conflict and the situation here can seem super complicated. And one of the things ICAD strives to do again and again is try to show that it's really not a complicated situation. If you break it down into its different parts, And if you explain it, I want to say clearly, but it's more than just being clear. Like, it's super fact-based. You can, by using these facts, you can give an analysis which helps to understand. And I think that's what ICAD's aim is, to provide analysis that helps people to understand the situation here. It's not an analysis which is easy to swallow. It's not easy to come to terms with. It's painful and difficult, but it's important. It's vital that we take responsibility for the situation. So what ICAD's doing, first of all, we take out groups, many, many different groups, on tours of East Jerusalem and the Jordan Valley, the Old City, the whole ranges of people, you know, from literally all over the world, in Japan, Europe, US, Canada, South Africa, and then in terms of the types of people, there's so much different, so different, students, diplomats, journalists, pilgrims, lots of church groups, in fact, and a lot from the US, which is really great. And
can I quickly ask, how are the church groups?
They often with? They'll get in touch with, they'll have a tour operator within Bethlehem or Jerusalem, and those tour operators are aware of, and they know of, political organizations like ICAD that do tours, that provide political tours. And so, you know, they're on a pilgrimage for 10 days and they'll go to all the regular holy sites and the Jordan River and so on and so forth, but they'll also do a sort of a political tour of Jerusalem as well.
Mm. Do you think they can do that because, like, they can side with the Palestinian Christians in a way, like, they have
it's usually the Palestinian Christian tour guide, like, tour operator that organises the whole pilgrimage for them, and we're an aspect of that pilgrimage.
That's really great.
And then students, lots of student groups, and then individuals, you know, people who are working here and have got family visiting and they want them to do a tour. Actually, that's the tour I had today, was with a whole bunch of different individuals that have got in touch with me separately. I had an Israeli on my tour today as well, left-wing Israeli, but yes, who has a friend here from Germany and wanted him to do a tour. So people get to us from all sorts of places and all walks of life, which is great. I had a Jewish rabbi on a tour with me last year, who's living here and wanted a... She said to me, I grew up hearing only the Israeli side of the story. I want you to open my eyes. And I think I did. A lot. More than she expected, I think.
She go home heartbroken, slightly?
Well, she lives here, so okay. I'm hoping... who knows what happened with her in the end. But a lot of groups, and we also take tours abroad. So Jeff and I have both been on speaking tours where we'll go to other countries and do a speaking tour, lecturing about the situation here. And as much research as possible, you know, we try and keep our website updated as often as possible. And Jeff will write articles and analysis to all sorts of things going on, you know, that's happening right now, whether it's the lack of negotiations or the situation with the UN or the policy at the moment with house demolitions in Jerusalem that seems to have gone up quite a bit. Mm.
Great organisation.
I should also say that we have the summer camp every year that we hold, and we rebuild a demolished home, which is amazing. And that's a summer camp for internationals to come and join. And they do meet both Israeli and Palestinian activists on the summer camp. And it's not only just rebuilding a demolished home, but also doing a study tour where we take people around to loads of different places, both within Israel and Palestine, with the aim of creating advocates, basically. These guys go back armed with knowledge of the situation and feel really that they have a good grasp on the situation, and they can go back to their own countries and continue their work there supporting ICAD, which is great. And we also have ECOSOC status in the UN, which I think I should mention because it's quite unique and important to us, where we can act as consultants within the United Nations. So we can participate in reports, analysis, we can lobby directly in the UN, which is fantastic. We have chapters both in the UK and in the US and New York that do that within our New York office, and then in Geneva with the UK office.
Great. So if someone wanted to sign up for the summer camp building, is that out yet?
Yeah. The information's on our website. It starts on the 3rd of August. And it lasts for 2 weeks. So if you just go to ICAD.org, and then follow the link to the summer camps and upcoming summer camps, and the information will be on there. But actually also on the homepage itself, if you scroll down, there's a whole detailed explanation of the summer camp, plus the email for the contact for Canada and the US, if anyone's interested in joining.
Wow, that's great. That's a lot of information for everyone who's listening. And like Ruth said, the website does have a lot on it. And there's endless amounts of reports and facts and answers and questions. And it's a really, really great resource. And so if you want any more of kind of the percentages, you know, numbers and stats, it's all there. So is there any last thing you want to say, or?
Just to say that I think, I mean, the situation is obviously very, very difficult, and sometimes me and my friends say that depression is literally the most normal reaction you could have to being here, and seeing what's going on, which, you know, we laugh and joke about it, but I think it's important to say that there are tiny, tiny bits of hope, and there are tiny, tiny things that are happening, like literally drops in the ocean, which are happening, which I think, I don't know if it's coming about because of international pressure on Israel. I do think that's an aspect of it, and I think also the rocky relationship that Israel and the US is finding itself in now. Israel's being a bit more careful about what it's doing. It's about a month ago. New sign was put up in East Jerusalem in the main valley where Ras Al-Amud and Jabal Muqabah, and they're going to be doing road works on this main road, which means they're going to be improving something in that area. It's tiny. It's not even a drop in the ocean of what East Jerusalem needs in terms of infrastructure, but it's a start. And if it is because of international pressure, then it just means we need to keep it up and that it does work. And if Israel needs to be forced into change, then it needs to be forced into change. But I think it's responsibility of everyone around the world who is a little bit aware to put that pressure on.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
To reiterate, the website is icahd.org, which is ICAHD.org.
Great. Thanks very much, Nick.
Okay, bye.
Bye.